I want to hand things over now to Jeffrey Busgang, our first interviewer of the day. Jeffrey's a partner at Flybridge Capital in Boston. He's the author of the blog Seeing Both Sides, which I think was the very first VC blog here in the Boston area. He wrote a book that came out last year called Mastering the VC Game that's almost out in paperback. Yes, later this year.
The publishing industry is unbelievably slow. So when you finish the manuscript, as you know, Scott, it takes 6 months for it to get into dead pulp on your doorstep. Unbelievable. So it won't be out until the summer.
All right, summer. You can take that to the beach with you. Jeffrey's also an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School now, and he's written some really interesting case studies over the last year on companies like 38 Studios, Kurt Schilling's video game company, and more recently, Foursquare. And on the entrepreneurial side of things, Jeff was part of the early team at Open Market and You Promise here locally. So please welcome Jeffrey Busgang and Paul English.
Thank you. So I'm going to get up because I'm just going to show a couple things on the screen, and then I'll sit down and we'll have our conversation. But I'm really excited to interview Paul, a company and an entrepreneur I've admired for a long time. I saw Paul at the Nantucket Conference, which Shane and Scott also organized last May, and that's a plug for that conference because I think registration is open. And Paul just gave a terrific interview and highlighted a lot of really interesting things about the early days of Kayak that I want to bring to light today and also go deeper on. What I won't talk about is what you read about in the news. So I'm not going to talk about the FTC, ITA, Google trade, antitrade business, and I'm not going to talk about the IPO in registration because those are things that Paul can't talk about, and besides, it's really not the purpose of today. The purpose of today is really talk about company building. But since the S-1 was filed in November and it is a public document, I thought I would show at least a little bit of data, just so you have a sense of the scope of Kayak. And where's my browser? Did you close my browser? There's Scott's music. Oh, there's the browser. Thank you. So there are two things really striking in the S-1. For those of you who have not gone on to Edgar and read it in its entirety, and the beautiful thing about S-1s, which I hope we all have the privilege of reading a lot more of, is they're actually very fun documents to read because you really get to see a lot about the company. But you know, I just want to show the numbers, just so you have a sense of the scale of Kayak. So in the closing quarter, September 30 quarter, the company did just under $50 million of revenue and just under $9 million of operating income, so a run rate of about $200 million of revenue and $40 million in operating income. Closing quarter Q3, Q4 obviously is always a big quarter. I don't think that's yet reported, right? You haven't reported that,
no.
Right? And but the company was founded in 2004, so just give you a sense, right, and went live in 2005, so just give you a sense of speed and scale on comparables in the public markets that all of us can look at. You know, this company, if it were to go public, would be worth, you know, don't consult your investment bankers and tax attorneys on this, but you know, just looking at the comps would be worth around $1 billion. So just to give you a sense, which puts Paul in a very elite group of entrepreneurs in this community, along with Andy Ori from Acme Packets and Gail Goodman from Constant Contact and Mike Simon from Log Me In, many of whom were part of last year's summit or this year's summit, of entrepreneurs who built from the beginning and continued over a 6 to 8 year period companies worth over $1 billion. So really, really exciting. But the thing that I want to spend time on today and to start with is actually the second paragraph in the strength section of the prospectus. I've never seen this done. I have read a lot of S-1s. Like I said, I wish I were reading more, but I have read a lot of them. And I've never seen a company articulate as their strength the fact that they have an intuitive user experience as their number two strength, number one just being it's a great product for consumers, number two, the intuitive user experience. I think that's the really defining thing about Kayak and what Paul has built, and that's where I want to start, which is because it's really what everyone aspires to, is how do you build, by the way, do you want this up or do you want PowerPoint up? Okay, so really what everyone aspires to, Paul, which is how to build this extraordinarily compelling user experience. And I just love your thoughts on just to begin with that. You know, what's the magic formula for building this extraordinarily simple and intuitive user experience?
You know, so for me, at Kayak and other ventures that I've done before, but I've started, Kayak is my fourth or fifth company based on how you count. That's one I'm trying to forget. But my skills have been getting a little bit better each time. And I think with Kayak, my priorities are very clear. If you ask any employee at Kayak, it's team first, customer second, and profit third. And on the user experience, customer design, I think that being relentless about recruiting, about hiring, and about firing, unfortunately, and trying to find the magic team and the magic designers and people who are really energized and have fun working together extremely fast, and then organizing them around a mission of doing something compelling for customers. We, you know, the way we work at Kayak is, I think we have more customer inputs. Like on our tech team, we have 130 employees right now. I think of the 130, there's about 95 that are in technology. And I think of our tech team, compared to other companies I've seen in the travel industry and elsewhere, we have dramatically more customer interface than other companies.
When you mean customer interface, you mean touch points? You mean
touch points.
Email, yeah, inbound?
We have eight key processes by which customers give input into the design process and into engineers. The one that's most frequent is what you just mentioned, email. Right now, like on a typical day, we might have 2 to 3 million customers come to the website. Any inquiry they send to us, we actually don't have customer service people. Our engineers answer all the questions. And you might say...
You don't have a single customer service person?
No.
So when I email, I go to kayak.com and I whine about something on the website. I hit the whine button, contact now button. That's an email that goes to one of your engineering team members.
Yeah, and friends of mine who are entrepreneurs don't believe me. They say the numbers don't work. How can you have millions of people and then 100 employees who answer all of these? And we answer them. We try to answer them in real time.
I think the number was 2 million.
2 to 3 million people.
2 to 3 million transactions.
Yeah, and let's say 100-ish people. And the trick is, this is something that would be hard to retrofit into each of your companies after the fact. But if you're really aggressive to deploy this on day one, and you make it part of your culture, what happens is the engineers don't write bad code, because you write bad code, the customers scream at you, and you don't have time to continue writing bad code. You have to fix your bad code. And it's really, if you guys don't believe me in the audience, go to kayak.com/feedback, send a message. You can use your Hotmail, whatever address you have.
Are you live streaming? Because I don't want this to take down the company. I mean, if 150 people do it, it's one thing.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, delayed. Good. Okay.
It's fine. I mean, test us out and send a feedback with any random question, and you'll be surprised. And you'll get a lot of answers from me. So I personally read every feedback that comes in. Another thing that...
Pause on that? Because I think that's really important. Scott mentioned I teach a little bit at Harvard Business School, and I wrote a case on Foursquare.
Yep.
And in interviewing Dennis Crowley, the founder and CEO of Foursquare, and talking about his MO... and what made that company early in finding product market fit so successful, just as you did, it was all about this, which is that the CEO, the CTO, the founders, they follow every Twitter stream, every comment, every email, and personally react and respond.
Yeah, we're hardcore about it. If you come visit us in Concord, Mass, right on Route 2 across from Paparazzi here, you'll see we have a number of monitors up on the walls, and they're all tracking in real time how customers experience on the site, and can be Twitter feedback, et cetera. We take a random exchange between a Kayak employee and a customer every day, and we email that out to the whole team and to all of our investors. And so we might have Michael Moritz at Sequoia gets an email that's an exchange between a new programmer and a customer saying, you motherfucker screwed up the flight to my honeymoon or whatever. What happened to this airline, delayed the flight last week, didn't tell me. And so we'll go back and forth in that interchange once a day. That's going to go out to our investors.
So let me push you on something, because I think this notion of responding to customer feedback is really interesting, because you also, in the early days, hear a lot of startups say, look, it's my vision. I don't want to just react to the feature request from the customer. I want to put forward my vision, particularly when it comes to the 0.1 and the 1.0 versions. Yeah. How do you think that through?
It's a good question. We talk about it all the time at Kayak. I would say of the 8 processes by which we get input, and we're really, really intense about it, how to use ability focus groups, answer the phone, et cetera, we are very, very hungry to understand not just what they experience, but kind of root cause and what they're thinking and what their background is. And I talk to a lot of customers on the phone as well. However, as intense as we are in talking to customers, we do not let our customers design our product. If they were product designers, they'd work for me. We don't let them even prioritize in what order to build and what features to build. But I think in order to build a winning product, it does need to come top down. It needs to be something that you feel good about.
Does that change early days versus later days?
I mean, hopefully not.
There's a point of view that in the early days you want to be very hunch driven in terms of what your view is of what the product should look like and the priorities, and in the later days you want to be more data driven.
We are data driven.
How do you think about that?
We have a chief scientist who brought on board a couple of years ago, Yugo Sakarya from MIT, and he built a whole machine learning platform, an analytics platform for us. And we do have an internal dashboard that you can drill down and ask, you know, any question. What customers use this filter in a hotel product by browser, by connection speed, by region, based on their fifth visit? I mean, we have a pretty detailed analytics platform, but we use that to inform our decision. The problem is if you become data-driven, you build boring products.
Right.
And if you look at companies, a lot of companies in the travel industry who are big companies worth a lot of money, and you compare their products a year ago to today, they haven't changed. And at Kayak, we do believe very much, we still believe in being gut-driven, and we also believe in being small in number of employees. You've seen, if you look at the S1 numbers, you know, we're around $2 million revenue per employee. It's very, very important to us to stay small, because I think by staying small and being incredibly good at hiring and firing, you can build that team that can, you know, where instincts matter, and you can also use data.
So let me push on the product question a little more. You have a team that's a great team. They're empowered. They're getting a lot of customer feedback. They're seeing daily emails. They're seeing emails from the customer base, tweets, et cetera. And they come to you and say, hey, we got all these features we want to put in. We've got all these ideas. They're creative. They're entrepreneurial. That's what you hire them for.
Yeah.
But you want to be top-down. You want to be prioritized. And you want to be simple. I mean, the one, and focused. Tumblr is a terrific product that I've been having a lot of fun with lately. And, you know, the striking thing about Tumblr, and the founder of Tumblr said this the other day, you know, the hardest product decisions you make are the features you don't put in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, keeping it simple. Yeah. So how do you balance entrepreneurial, aggressive, smart, getting a lot of customer feedback, engineers and product people, with that notion of keep it simple, top down, making hard decisions?
Yeah, the point you made about defining a product by what's not in it, I think is a general point in life. One of the nonprofits I'm on the board of, we're looking for a new executive director right now, and we wrote up a job description. And I looked at the job description written up by my colleagues, and I was like, this is overwhelming. In the job description, we need to say, here's all the stuff you're not going to have to do as executive
director. Right, because they threw everything in.
Yeah, so in terms of Kayak, for product design, if you go to kayak.com/more, you'll see a lot of our side projects and utilities, kind of like a labs experimental that the engineers are playing around with. In addition to that, we have internal tools that we have not even exposed to the public, and we do let engineers screw around. We don't do the, you know, Google claim where engineers get 20% off, which is not true, according to my friends who work at Google.
But it sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good. We do let programmers, if there's something they feel passionate about, absolutely let them build prototypes, but ultimately, it is kind of, we let them build prototypes and let a couple of customers see it, but unless it catches on fire, the reality is it is kind of top down. I'll look at everything we're doing.
And even still, because one of the things you hear about is, and you know, this is a summit all about what do you do when you scale. And one of the key lessons of scaling is delegation and empowerment. You hire great people, you want to give them authority. So do you find that, tell me about that transition and where are you in that spectrum and how do you make those decisions? To what extent do you keep that top-down focus, hey, it's my product, it's my vision, this is my decision, versus stand back, you hired great people, you built great process, let that do its work?
I think the most important thing for a startup in particular is top-down to establish a culture under which people can innovate. You know, Bill Warner, who's a friend of many people in this room, great entrepreneur in Boston, has a talk that he gives called invention from intention. And he'll frequently interview founders and say, why are you doing this company? And you answer. And they'll say, but why are you really doing the company? And you'll answer.
It's like the five whys.
But why are you really doing the company?
Right.
And I have another friend who recently reminded me that the word integrity doesn't mean being a nice person. Integrity means honest, means consistency. And so I put those two things together, and I think in order to building an innovative culture, there's this top-down thing, which is, who are you? Like, who are you as a person, an entrepreneur? And if that's clear in the company, what the values are and consistency, and you can hire and fire, you know, the right team, the team executes very, very efficiently. And I, you know, I'm at the point of CAG where I am not involved in every product decision. I do get, I'm involved in strategic decisions. I look at, you know, a lot of UI. But a lot of it is we evolve as a culture. And that evolution comes from a top-down. This is a statement of honestly who we are. And then as you hire people into the team and they make significant contributions, they can evolve that. But it's important throughout the whole company that you have that integrity of let's not pretend to be a different company.
Right.
Let's actually be who we are.
Right. I read a story that I think you posted in your blog about the big red phone.
Yeah.
And it reminded me, I want you to tell the story, but it reminded me of Scott Cook of Intuit. And some of the techniques he used, and I know you worked at Intuit,
yeah.
And that was probably very influential. And I'd love to talk about that because I think the Intuit product management culture may be the best in the world. And
yeah.
I don't know if everybody fully appreciates it, but Scott Cook used to send engineers home with customers with the boxes out
right.
of the retail store. So you walk into a retail store back in the old days when such things existed, you'd pick up a box of software, you'd take it home with you, and an engineer would knock on your door. And say, can I hang out in your living room and watch you open up that software and watch you install and watch you use? And engineers would do that,
right.
not customer service
right.
people. So it's, you have a, sort of an interesting...
Yeah, so I worked for Scott for 3.5 years, and it wouldn't be quite that creepy. It's more like they would stand in Staples, and when you bought it, they would have a business card or an impact saying, I actually work for Intuit. I can help you install that or watch you install it. But I had a company which I sold to Intuit back in, I don't know, 99, and I worked with Scott for 3.5 years. He was an incredible mentor to me, and I've learned a lot from him. I was in an executive meeting once where we were debating something about QuickBooks, and it was going on and on and on, and after a while, you see Scott kind of look at the floor and steam coming out of his ears, and you know you're about to be hit by something. And Scott said, all you guys, your opinions are very interesting, but there's a phone right there. Can someone please call a customer and see what they think? And it sort of chilled the room, and that was a meaningful event to me. And so the red phone story at Kayak is, I've always done the customer support myself from day one. I tried to do all of it. And at one point, I decided to get the engineers involved in it. And
it was too overwhelming for you.
Well, it wasn't overwhelming. I mean, I always joke that I'm a fast. I can type 120 words a minute, so I could keep up with it. It was more that I would ask engineers. I would see this bug 3 or 4 times, ask engineers to fix it, and then put it on their list rather than fix it. And I said, you know, if I make the engineers actually talk to the customers, by the second or third time they answer the question, they'll be sick of answering it, and they'll fix it. But the phone thing was, I'm always looking to innovate our customer interaction processes because I don't want my engineers to become tired of how it works. I'm always changing things around. And after the email at one point, I wanted more interaction. So I went online and tried to find a red, like Batman phone with a mechanical ringer that was really loud. And the story is, I plug it in, put the phone up on a website, and when it rings, it's really loud because it's a mechanical ringer. And the engineers would say...
Where'd you find the phone?
Where everything that I buy online these days,
you just
I probably
found
it on Amazon through a reseller
right.
that sells on Amazon.
So it's a big, goofy, old red
yeah.
phone
and,
with a super loud ringer.
We have a few of them, actually, of different styles. But the engineers would say, this is really annoying. You know, this is loud. And I would say, there's a very simple solution to that.
Fix the problem.
No, it's like this thing here, you hold your hand on it, you lift it up, and it stops ringing. And then you say, hello, and there's someone on the other side. And what you do is you basically stop everything you're doing, and you do whatever it takes to make them happy. You make jokes, you know, whatever it is. And you hang up, you write up the case, you fix the code. And then if it rings a little too often, you can unplug the phone, run down the other end of engineering, and plug it in down there. And it's become a little bit of a joke, but we do take it seriously. And if you visit Kayak, like, you'll literally see me jumping over desks to answer that phone. A big conflict at Kayak, because I've said team first, customer second, profit third, if I'm interviewing someone at Kayak for a job,
and the phone rings,
he'll see me almost self-destruct. It's very, very difficult. And if there's a, if Joel Cutler from General Catalyst is there, you'll see I'll completely ignore Joel. our main investor, because he knows I'm focused
customers,
on recruiting more engineers.
Right, teams first.
Yeah, but it is part of the culture.
That's great. All right, let's talk about team and recruiting. You told a story which I still find hard to believe, so I want to really push it, that you ask everybody you know who's a home run person, A-plus
yeah.
person, that you just think is an extraordinary individual. And when you get that name, you challenge yourself to contact that individual, bring them in, interview them, do reference checking, make them an offer, and close them within 7 days.
Of hearing their name.
Of hearing their name.
Yeah.
So is that real?
It is. I have a daily report, which I can show you on my BlackBerry, that sends me how long people have been in the pipeline. If Scott mentions the name to me and I tell Scott, who's the best marketer you ever met, like the smartest, fastest marketer, he tells me a name, and I'll say, where is she? And he'll say, I don't know, I met her in L.A. The clock starts ticking. He hasn't yet given me her email or her phone. He doesn't even know where she lives, but the clock has started ticking. And, some people don't believe me, and they'll say, won't you make mistakes if you hire
yeah.
that fast? My reply to that is, if you've ever watched a Formula One race and you watched how fast the pit crew changes a tire, they're pretty fast. They generally don't make mistakes. And if you do a process quickly, it means you have to well define it. And I don't think dragging it out for 3 weeks makes you do a better job. I think by accelerating it to a week energizes the candidate. We have a particular style of how we interview.
What if you don't like the candidate? What if, no offense, Scott's
yeah.
judgment or the person just isn't that great?
I mean, we'll take them out of the process quickly, but we try to do it in a way that they still are excited about the company. We had a woman we interviewed a few years ago. I need to abstract this, so there's no possibility this is identifiable. And we decided it wasn't the right fit. And she went home energized about the company, and she told a friend of hers about Kayak.
How great a company it was.
How great a company it was. So this person is very close to her, called us up, and actually made a pretty interesting proposition to us, basically saying, based on what he heard, this guy had unbelievable cred. He said, he'll work for us for free. At the end of 6 months, we'll decide how much to pay him or not. And the fact that someone that we rejected would refer someone close to them with good cred would make us that offer just says that even when we reject someone, we try to have them walk away electrified. That's probably
right.
way too strong a statement, but we want to make sure that we're connected to the community.
So tell me about the process. You said you have a very unique process. Give us a little insight into it.
Yeah, so first of all, there's a criteria by which we evaluate candidates. At Intuit, I was VP technology, but I also taught a recruiting class. This took me 2 hours. I'll try to boil this down to 2 minutes. So first of all, it's finding candidates. And there's this thing where they say B's recommend C's, and A's recommend A's. A's actually sometimes recommend B's. Some people are really amazing, but they don't quite have the ability to find amazing people.
Right.
There's a funny story about most beautiful women in Italy, which I can tell for another time. It has to do with a Japanese game show. It's a very funny story about trying to find someone at the top and have them refer people to the top. But so there's kind of the hunting
ground. We'll put that under momentum / more.
Okay. There's trying to find the candidates and some aggression in that and trying to identify people. And once you've identified them, I do a back channel first. So I do a back channel, assuming I find a lead. And LinkedIn I love.
Because you can always get to a
love
back channel.
Love LinkedIn. And I think it is important for people to have hundreds of connections on LinkedIn because there's so many cool things I've gotten done by finding people through LinkedIn.
Do you always do a live voice back channel? Or do you do email back channel?
It depends how well I know them. If they know someone that I know really, really well, I'll do email.
You'll do email.
But in general, I'll do live voice.
Yeah.
So I'll get a quick reference, and then I'll call the candidate. And I'll do, if they seem really good and the first back channel is good, I'll do whatever it takes to get a meeting with them. And I'll say, I'll come to you. I'll fly to where you are. I'll meet you on Saturday morning. Come meet me for coffee. And we try to meet like the next day or that day.
What's the most insane meeting that you've ever engineered through that?
I don't know. I've flown places to meet candidates. I don't do that for every candidate, but if someone
yeah.
is extraordinary, we tried to recruit Greg Slingstad to join our board. Greg was the original founder of Expedia. And we called him. Greg was retired out of Expedia for some years. And Greg's like, well, I'm kind of retired. I'm sailing around the world with my family, and I don't really want to join boards. And we're like, Greg, you have to join our board. And we were just very aggressive.
Persistent.
It was Joel Cutler, myself, and Steve Hafner, my co-founder. in going after him. And I think from him being, I have no interest whatsoever, to getting him to agree to really be kind of a co-founding board member, I think it took us about a week of chasing him.
That's
and having him see the aggression from us. But our process is you identify them, you back channel, you get a meeting with them the next day. And I find that getting a meeting with someone the next day is actually not that hard. Because if you tell someone, oh, let's meet, and they'll say, I'll have my assistant call your assistant, we'll schedule something out 3 weeks. A meeting 3 weeks from now is the same amount of time as a meeting tomorrow. And so I just try to encourage them, let's just get half an hour tomorrow. What's your schedule? I'll find a slot in tomorrow, just like I could 3 weeks from now. We'll try to find that slot. And you try to make them laugh on the phone and all that. So you back channel, meet them once. If you like them, you try to bring them in, like the next day, to meet people at Kayak. I'll always have them come into Kayak because I want them to get a vibe for our office. And they'll come and meet people. At most, my interview team is 6 people. They have in cases where I'll do more. I never have a Kayak employee on the interview team unless I give them veto power because that would be offensive. If I waste time of my engineer to evaluate a candidate when I'm not going to listen to that engineer, I'd be pissed off if I was that engineer. Giving people veto power sounds crazy because what if just there's not chemistry between one person out of the 6? Well, I actually would rather lose a good person than to risk hiring someone bad, because I do think that if you have an aggressive recruitment policy, there's ways to find more good people out of that. But in the interview the first day, we have a particular way we interview. There's particular things we look for. For me, it's bandwidth, attitude, diversity of success, and lack of dysfunctional behavior are my 4 criteria. So we have a way we interview.
I think there's a book, the No Asshole Rule.
Is there a book called that? There is, right? Okay, a lot of companies have the no asshole rule.
You have a broader definition of dysfunctional behavior, I assume.
Well, we actually have a rule that I call the no neutrals rule. And the way it works is, if you hire someone who's amazing, let's say you have this product manager, and she's been with you for a year, and she's really, really amazing. Everyone loves her. Fits the culture, leadership at Kayak. And then we hire a new director of engineering.
Yeah.
A new programmer. And he's walking down the hall. All right, let me do the reverse. So she's awesome, been with a while. She walks down the hall, and he turns his head up. Does she divert her glance towards him, away from him? I just, you know, keep walking straight. If she diverts her glance away from him, and she's awesome, that means she is someone, or he's someone, who robs people of energy. So I fire him. Okay, I'm not exactly literal here. I'm trying to condense this. If she just keeps looking straight, he's not an energy amplifier. I fire him. I'm doing this backwards. Yeah, I fire him. But the main thing is the way you get $2 million revenue per employee.
Yeah.
And right now, Expedia, for example, is actually a great partner of ours, and they have a different business model. But they're the number one travel company in terms of number of users per day and per month. The day we beat them, which we will, on that criteria, I'd like to be 2% their size in terms of staff. And the only way you can get high revenue per employee is you have to have a commitment to your employees saying, I'm going to hire incredible people. And wherever you sit, we have no offices, so we sit in like a newsroom style. And it's a fun environment. It's kind of crazy. But wherever you sit, the 4 people sitting around you are going to be electric. And if you're really, really good, and I have one of those 4 that's not electric, there's no way I'm going to get $2 million revenue per employee.
Right.
Because they're not going to challenge you and grow you.
So let me get a sense of this environment. You've got this red phone ringing all the time. Mm-hmm. You've got,
It looks like a trading desk with monitors all over the place.
You're jumping, grabbing people and saying, I need you to do an interview tomorrow for this fantastic technology director. Come in and spend 30 minutes, an hour here or there. You got 8 customer feedback streams, and you have this open office environment with no borders. How do you not create this incredible bias towards an interrupt, short twitch muscle culture versus a thoughtful, long twitch muscle culture?
So we have, there's one way, there's a Canadian philosopher and researcher, I think he's passed away now, named André Jacques. I learned about many years ago, I took a class at HBS. And he has a thing on human cognitive levels, which is a way to evaluate people for job based on how long their assignment is. Is there an employee you have to give feedback every hour, every day, every 3 days, every week, every month, whatever? And he had these 8 levels. I think there's a way to evaluate companies based on this as well. And my thing in terms of how Kayak operates, in terms of are we Twitch-driven or not, I would say we have integrity in terms of everyone in the company knows who we are just because we're honest about it. We're not pretending that we're a different company. So that is the most important thing, that we all rally around. Really fun team. We're trying to create the best, most fun place that people have worked in their career. And then, you know, the customer thing, and then the profit thing. So there's the integrity first.
Yeah.
And that, to me, creates a company which can be 30 or 50 years old or more. Because if you have that, that's really strong and honest. The next thing is we have one-year financial plans. And so we have a goal that we set forth to the board, and we sign up for our bonuses based on these numbers. We have particular ways to come up with that. And then beyond that, our product plan is only, we only have two product plans, a 30-day plan and a 90-day plan. Our website updates once a week. It'll update tomorrow morning with new features. And
but if I'm writing software code, and you know, I used to write code many moons ago, it requires really deep thinking. I mean, anybody who's written code before knows that in this high interrupt culture, you lose your thread of seeing things through and thinking through all the possibilities and all the angles and all the permutations of what could happen, you know, what might not happen. How do you get this great code driven? Because you're a software driven culture.
We're a software company.
130 employees,
90, 100
engineers.
Yeah.
With this, again, this at risk of being this interrupt driven culture. And I push on this because I know a lot of startups I work with really struggle with this, because in the age of Twitter and real time, you know, they're really focused on this issue.
There's also a particular way in which you do email and how email comes in your job. It's very, very important. And we talk a lot about Twitter, et cetera. I think there's a, you know, email's old school, so we don't talk about it too much because none of our kids do email. My son, who's 16, said to me, "What is email? Like, why do you use email, Dad? Why, I don't understand. You send me email, but why should I read this?" But we don't actually talk enough about email. I think there's an issue about interrupt-driving as it relates to that. I mean, at Kayak, even though we have this identity, which is quite strong, one-year financial plan, we always have a 30-day product plan and a 90-day product plan that updates every month. The engineers are, it's a mix of kids right out of school to people with 20 years' experience. They're trying to build long-term architectures. I want to make sure they don't build, this is going to sound wrong, I want to make sure they don't build two long-term architectures. What I mean by that is I think it was Jim Geddes for the at MIT who did the X Windows. He had a sign once in his door that said, the only thing worse than generalizing from one, no, from generalizing from one example is generalizing from zero. And a lot of engineers are guilty of
generalizing from zero.
Yeah, what I call intellectual masturbation, which is the engineer gets all excited about, I could build this, and I could build this, and I could build this. And they end up building layers and layers and layers, but it doesn't solve a customer need.
Right.
And I would rather lean a little bit towards the customer need and a little bit being UI-driven. And then if we have to throw out code a little bit, throw out code a little bit. Now, the nice thing about our hiring is I talked about my criteria number three, diversity of success, is I have long-term people on my team that are really, really good architects in high transactional systems, security, et cetera. And they kind of beat up the engineers that are more UI-focused.
Right.
And I think there's a healthy tension there. But we throw out code, and we re-architect along the way.
Right.
I don't want to sit back and have three-month product
cycles.
And
have long
though.
Cycles. I'm going to go to the audience for questions, and after this one last question I'll ask you. If you look at the history of the company, you took some initial money, you know, two founders came together, took some seed capital, kind of a lean startup culture, got some scale, raised more money, and then you had a lot of exit options. And at one point you decided to double down and merge with your number two competitor, which is a huge risk, but it's a statement of, hey, we're going to double down. And now you've filed for an IPO, which is another double down. What's that take in terms of the philosophy for the founder to not take the, I don't want to say the easy exit, but you build something, you create some momentum, you have an opportunity to monetize that in 3, 4, 5 years, and you elect to walk away time and time again to take it 7 years, 8 years, 10 years, and build a bigger company. And so what's, you know, we talk a lot about the need to do that more in this community. What's that mentality required to do that?
I mean, it's a couple of things. My co-founder and I, so Steve Hafner was one of the founders of Orbitz, was there for, I think, 4 years, fully vested, took it public as a co-founder, and then wanted to move back to the East Coast where he had
family. So he saw scale.
He made some money at Orbitz, and he saw some scale, and he didn't want to bet for small dollars. And then I was the same thing. I've sold a couple of companies, done well, and I didn't want to do that again. So I'd have been there and done that. And I wanted to raise the bar and say, how big a company can we build this time? And I don't want to sell a company for $30 million or $100 million. I want to do something much, much bigger. And the thing is, each time you get closer to the goal, you set the goal higher.
You just lift it up.
Yeah.
Lift it up.
Like when I advise grad students who come to me and say, I want to start a company or I want to get my first job, what should I do? Should I go work at IBM or should I work at a startup that's pre-funded? I'm answer to that is it's a very, very simple question. You go interview at IBM. You go interview with the pre-funded startup. You pick who are the three people at IBM you're going to work with really every day. Who are the three people at the startup? And you say, which of those team of three is stronger in terms of is going to give your team a likelihood of success for your product, and in terms of which one is going to make you stronger as a person. Whichever one is stronger, you pick that team. And then they'll say to me...
And I would say in this culture of small ecosystem, repeat startup culture, pick the team you're going to do three startups with.
Yeah.
Over 15 years,
right.
Not just this job.
Yeah. You want to pick people that you want to hang out with and that you think you can learn from. And for me, in terms of going for the big brand at Kayak, which is what we're trying to do, we want to. I almost don't want to tell you what we're actually thinking about because
how high the
laugh
bar
at
is
me.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's high, but
well, you said bigger than Expedia.
That's
2%
of
the employees.
Yeah, that's one step. But in terms of how high the bar is and turning down a lot of opportunities we would have had for exit over the last few years, it's one of these things. Just like I advise entrepreneurs, they'll say, "Well, how did you get? How did you raise that much money or get Mike Moritz digitally on your board or whatever? Can I do that?" And I'll say, "Well, maybe or maybe not. You can get Sequoia in." But one way to think about as a company, what goals should you set, or as an entrepreneur, pick goals that are a little bit higher than what you think you can set, and then crush it. And once you've done that,
raise
the bar.
Right.
And
because
your confidence increases.
That's great advice. All right, let me open it up to the audience and get some questions from the group. Here in the back.
So you talked a little bit about how you handle hiring, which is great, but you also said you're great at firing. Can you talk about how you approach that?
So the question for the people listening at home is, you're great at hiring. How do you approach firing?
Yeah, I think one thing that's not talked enough about in venture-backed startup environments and really in all companies is trying to be world-class at firing. It's a tough thing to say. You want to be good at it, and it's a very, very difficult thing to do. I've been in software for 20 years. I've been a manager for 10 or 15 years, and I've been firing for 10 or 15 years, hopefully a lot more hiring than firing. And each time I do it, I still literally, get sick the night before. It's
hard. You get
that
pit in the stomach.
Yeah.
Heartbeat goes up.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad. It's painful. And it's not just painful for me. It's much more painful for the other person because they actually lose their job. Now, if you do get fired in Boston, you want to get fired from Kayak because we're really, really generous. Like, we help people find jobs. We do a lot. And we try to stay really good friends with them. I'm actually friends with two or three people that we fired. Because a lot of times when you fire someone, it's not that they're jerks. Like, you don't hire people that are jerks.
Yeah, it's a fit question.
It's whatever. It's not the perfect fit for your company
right.
at this stage, not fit for them or whatever. And you want to make the decision as quickly as you can. And then, you want to do it with dignity for the person and kind of protect them. But it is important. And this thing about me, I make a commitment to every employee who starts at Kayak. I always say, in addition to, I'll try to close people before I offer them a salary. I'll try to get them to agree to work at Kayak. And some of those candidates says, what do you mean? Like, how can I accept this job? You even told me I'm just going to get paid. And I'll say, there'll be an offer letter. I'm going to pay you a salary. You have a title and all that stuff. But in addition to that, there's a psychological contract between you and me as a co-founder. And this relates to the firing thing. And I'll say, you promise me two things. I'll promise you two things. The two things you promise me is I'm going to be the best QA engineer in the U.S., if I'm hiring you for that. And I'll be an energy amplifier. The two things I promise you is I only hire people who have had diversity of success. I don't care if you had an Olympic medal, a chess championship, but I want success. Whatever you've been productive at, I'll make you more productive. And I'm really, really serious about that. And the second one is I'm going to make you have fun. This is going to be a really, really fun job. I'm going to fail at that second one if I surround them with people that don't quite work. So my commitment to people on the team is no neutrals around you, and then make a decision quickly and do it with as much dignity as you can.
The other thing I would add, and at Open Market we went from 0 to 500 people in 5 years, and at You Promise we went to, during my 3-year tenure, to 0 to 100 people, and but did a lot of firing, in the middle of that, because when you're hiring that fast, you're culling, and being really clear about expectations and really direct about feedback. And having difficult conversations in a very direct and respectful fashion, I think, is an important best practice in firing as well.
And it's very, very difficult.
And it's hard.
Yeah. I'm sure I don't do a good enough job at that.
It's hard. Next question.
So.
Oh, sorry. Yep, here on the left.
Thanks. a question I have is, I'm sorry.
No, and then we'll go there.
Yep. Okay. Question I have is about firing. Once you fire, morale goes down.
Can I just say the economy, the recession is over? Like, a lot of firing questions coming.
That's right. Go ahead, though. I think this is leading to a good question.
Then you have other key people. Sometimes they leave, and then obviously they're working on important technology. Now suddenly you have a vacuum here, you know, somebody who's key there and, you know, quits, so now I have to replace that person. How do you deal with that?
So one is when we hire people, during the hiring process, I will tell them that we're trying to build a high-performance team, we're trying to build a Super Bowl team, and there's a chance that if this isn't a perfect fit, you're going to get cut. And unless you're willing to take that risk, you probably shouldn't come to Kayak. When we do cut someone from the team, it's a little shocking for the newer members of our team to say, wow, this other new person just got cut. But I'll go to them, and we'll constantly talk. The managers will be talking to people, checking in, and not just the managers, but kind of the leaders, individual leaders and managers. How you doing? How's it going? And if someone's ever concerned, we'll say, you know, remember that Super Bowl thing? We're really trying to build this great team. It's very painful for us to do this, but look at the people sitting around you. We're trying to build this really amazing team because it's the only way we're going to give you the thing we promised you in terms of best job of your career. And it does unsettle people a little bit, but then at the end of the day and the week and the month, when they go home and talk to their spouse about their job, they tend to say, there's good people sitting around me. This is a fun place.
I think also I would add, there's a culture of excellence that you create from the very top. And if it's not authentic from the top, then it doesn't cascade down. And so the leaders of the company need to also embrace this culture of excellence. You talked about, you know, who are you and why are you starting the company? Yeah. You know, to be authentic leaders, to be self-learners, to always be trying to self-improve, to be honest about what you're good at as a leader and where you need help. If the team sees the leaders behaving in that way, then it encourages them to behave that way as well.
Honesty is important. When my little company got acquired by Intuit, I spent some time with Bill Campbell and Scott Cook and others, and we came into Intuit, and there were some good things said about us and about me to some of the other executives, and it suddenly made me feel overwhelmed, like there was expectations were set too high. So I wrote up a self-assessment, and I gave it to my boss, and it said, I'm good at these three things, and I suck at these 10 things. And I basically said, I want to set expectations because I don't want to disappoint you a month from now. I want to be really clear that I'm terrible at these things. And I think almost when you hire someone, and there's a way you back-channel as well, that you try to identify those things, and if you identify them, you can diffuse them.
Here in the middle.
Actually,
wait, if you wouldn't mind, just wait 1 sec for the mic so we can get on tape. Thank you.
I'm very interested in this engineering doing support aspect. Could you go one level deeper into the mechanics of that? So an email comes in, how's it routed to who? How's it followed up on? Those kinds of things.
Yep. As odd as it might seem, we actually have a patent on the answer to this question. I am so obsessed with customer service, and I'm very familiar with the other systems on the market, Clarify, Remedy, Vantiv, you know, on and on and on. But because I wanted engineers to answer it, and I know how engineers work, because I'm a programmer by training, I'm actually not coding at Kayak, thank God for our programmers. But I know how engineers work, and a lot of how they work is in email. If I made them log on to a console, they wouldn't do it. Now the trick is, if we're getting hundreds of emails a day coming in, and I need to figure out who do I divert this to? As an engineer, if it goes to your email and you answer it and someone else has already answered it, that would be annoying because you'd have wasted time. So we have a particular way that we send the email to you, that the time you look at that email based on whatever email client you're using, there's an image in that email that at the time it's rendered, we tell you if that issue is still open or not. So there's an efficiency thing that we're threading it throughout your actual workday. And then there's all these rules. If there's a customer who've interacted with you a year ago, and we get an email from that customer, we direct it to you again so that, you know, you might remember them and they might remember you. There's certain keywords we use from time to time. If someone emails us with an expletive, it actually goes to me. And the reason is I love talking to passionate customers. And I just look at anger as they're passionate.
If I can
call them on the phone and joke with the right, you don't want to joke the wrong way, but if you can deal with them the right way, you can flip them really easily. So we have a router that we can program. It's a data-driven router that we can program very easily, and it's all driven in email.
I'll add another story or anecdote to this. I'm on a board with Scott Savitz, who's the founder and CEO of ShoeBuy. People may know ShoeBuy is the number two online e-commerce shoe reseller here based in Boston. Scott's it's a division of IAC, so it's private, but he's mentioned that they're over $1 million per employee and 200 employees, so kind of similar scale to Kayak. And Scott gets every customer inquiry on his email. And so when the engineers know that he's looking at those emails, they look at those emails as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, because the last thing they want is the CEO to forward them a note that's not being addressed. So everybody, people pay attention because they know everybody's paying attention to it. We have time for two more questions. Why don't I go here with the mic and then here to the right.
Thank you. Rodrigo Martinez. Paul, you talked a little bit about really listening to what customers are saying, wanting. Can you tell a little bit, talk a little bit about how are you pushing that more than actual focus groups and emails and phone calls?
Yeah, so you know, I mentioned we have 8 processes. We ran a focus group 3 weeks ago that we're getting a debriefing on at 11 a.m. this morning. We're getting a company meeting. We're going to talk about it. One of the things is we try to identify who within our team are the best empaths and the best listeners. And a lot of times you can come into a conversation with a customer with an agenda. So I can read a customer email and say, see, that proves the feature I've wanted, and forward that to the team and say, a customer said this, therefore we need to do it. But it's trying to listen to a customer without an agenda, and it's trying to ask the customer questions and not leading the customer, and just, you know, it's like the 5 whys. There's a woman on our team that does usability testing, and she's very good at it, and she's getting better and better at it. And I want to make sure that when we do usability testing, we have a formal thing. We use Marais software in 2 rooms. She and the prospective travelers in 1 room, and the engineers all sitting in another room. And we want to make sure that when we conduct that usability, we don't bring any bias into it at all, and we catch it on videotape. And then afterwards, we sort of post-process. So I think a lot of it is getting the data as raw as we can, trying not to do real-time interpretation. That tends to put a lens on it, shape them. There's an if you study anthropology, there's a statement, I forget who said this, which is to observe is to change. And if you're not careful, the way you observe and the way you're listening can change someone. And there's rules you can learn in therapy about how you deal with your spouse. And there's just active listening techniques that you can deploy in terms of how you get to customers and withhold judgment a little bit later.
For those of you who thought we were going to have a software technology session, we've got a couch here behind us for the deeper. Last question, I think, right, Scott? Or do we have time for any?
Great.
Last one.
Great, thank you. Not a question about therapy of any kind. But I am curious about the management culture that you're developing. Obviously, you're very engaged at every level yourself. We're having a little bit of a transition in our firm from older guard to newer guard, and we've got some issues around people taking on the mantle of managerial roles. So could you speak to that? And then I have one very small side question, and that is what Jeff referred to as the disruptive environment. How do you control that? Do you manage that, or do you just let it ride?
Yeah, so I don't. One of the reasons I'm not at Intuit, Intuit's a great, great company, and I learned an enormous amount there, but I'm not a great manager at a big company.
That was one of your 10 things.
Right. When I make mistakes at Kayak, which I do every day, I will tell the team members, my venture capitalists don't pay me to be a great manager. If we want to find, you know, if we meet someone who's a great manager, they should go work at IBM or Fidelity if they want to be a great, like, big manager. But what we try to build at Kayak is entrepreneurial managers, which is different. I think in terms of transition, it's very, very difficult for a startup to bring outside managers in because then they're spending a year trying to prove themselves to the team internally, just incredibly inefficient. One of the things I do when I bring outside managers in, I just tell them explicitly, go hire 3 people at the same time you come in, because the best way to prove yourself is have a team that's already loyal to you. And people, not at Kayak, but at prior companies, say to me, that's scary, they're going to change the culture. And I would say, why would you ever hire a manager if you didn't trust them to bring some people and make you stronger? In terms of promoting internal people to managers, the most difficult thing I've seen is you promote a first-level manager to a second-level manager. But going from an individual to a manager, they do want to keep their fingers in the code and everything, and you just need to teach them to trust people. And you need to teach them to let people make mistakes. And so a lot of times, I'll spend time with those managers, and they'll give me feedback about the team, and they'll have angst. And the managers who are really good and who can accelerate, you know, in the organization, go from manager to director to VP, are ones who can learn to let people make mistakes. And the ones who hold their fingers in are ones that are slower who might, you know, that's what they might want to do, is just stay close. So it's all about, you just set a really firm thing, this is our direction, and let people execute against it, or do you feel the need? And I think you have to find what's the right solution for each manager. I don't know if I answered it, but...
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. You know, in the S1, there's a reference to unaided awareness for the brand, and Kayak's unaided awareness, according to the S1, is 20% as of the measurement that was taken. And I just really want to thank you for helping make the unaided awareness of the story and the lessons behind the story in the, at least the Boston tech community, more like 80%. So thank
great,
you very much. Hope you're really successful.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody.